The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hello, and welcome to Capital Thinking Radio. I'm Rebecca Carr, a former national correspondent with Cox Newspapers, sitting in for Kevin O'Neill today. We have an exciting show lined up for you. First, we will discuss the expanding economic opportunities for companies working in the Homeland Security marketplace with Mark Pearl, President and CEO of Homeland Security and Defense Business Council. He will be joined by Norma Cram, a former official at the Transportation, State, and Commerce Departments. Next, we will talk to former federal prosecutor Todd Harrison about the Pentagon's recent decision to release two Guantanamo Bay prisoners against their will. Then, we take a look at the Chesapeake Crescent Initiative with Stephanie Carnes, Managing Director of the Initiative, and energy guru Joshua Green. Finally, we take on what's going on Capitol Hill with Gregory Walden, a nationally recognized aviation authority, about pending legislation to fund the FAA. Let's start with how to help businesses navigate the Homeland Security marketplace. First, a little background about Mark Pearl. Mark has been the president and CEO of Homeland Security and Defense Business Council since early 2008. The council is a vibrant council based here in Washington, D.C. Its membership consists of the leading emerging companies who provide Homeland Security solutions to our nation. Joining Mark is Norma Cram, a former federal official and co-chair of the Homeland Security, Defense, and Technology Transfer Practice at Patton Boggs. Mark, let's start with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be with you.
Great. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council, how it got started, and what its overall goals are?
That's a good question, Rebecca. The council was formed almost 6 years ago by the leading providers of solutions in the Homeland Security marketplace. Many of those companies had provided the technology, product, and services solutions, and obviously other agencies in the federal government and state and local governments long before there was any even mention of Homeland Security. But coming out of the events of both 9/11, the anthrax event right after that, and obviously continuing on through a kind of all-hazards approach that the council and our nation has had to face, the companies came together with the idea in mind, not as much about business development as it was that in the formation of this new department, there needed to be substantive engagement, substantive interaction between industry and government in order to successfully achieve our mission of having a safer and more secure nation. And that's why the companies came together at the senior executive level to, in essence, work in partnership with the federal government and Congress on improving the and developing and implementing the best possible acquisition process, policy process, and solution process for our nation.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm sure, Norma, that you've come across the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council quite a bit in your efforts to represent private sector companies in Homeland Security in that marketplace. Can you talk, more, Norma, a little bit about the challenges facing some of those companies as they try to, you know, do what's right for the nation, yet yet expand their business in the federal marketplace?
Absolutely. I think one of the things groups like the one that Mark represents and private sector companies in general, they've done, I think, a very good job about trying to strike that balance. Having worked in both state and federal government, one of the things that I always very much appreciated was a private sector company who could come in and, using Mark's word, focus on the substantive expertise that they could bring to the table. Using words like thought leadership and other things, we hear them a lot, but what it really means is if private sector companies can focus on fixing the problems that the government has, maybe not necessarily fixing the problems that, that some of the companies would like them to have, that's where you have and you see a much closer and better collaborative role. There's been a lot of discussion, even in the recent papers, about the use of outside companies and outside contractors. I don't think that those companies should be demonized. They should be looked at, again, as a strategic partner. And again, having been in government, that doesn't mean that there's a lack of human capital within the government. It just means that some of these companies can really do a quicker, faster, more efficient job of meeting the demands of the government, and especially in Homeland Security. Look, we have terrorists and people who are very nimble, who are able to change and modify their approaches very quickly. And honestly, sometimes you really need that collaboration between private sector and government to meet those demands and really those concerns.
Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Norma is referring to the Washington Post's front page stories on the growth of federal contracting in the Homeland Security marketplace. Just to bring our listeners into the loop here, Mark, as you've read that series, I'm sure, what do you believe the private sector's role is in Homeland Security, and what is your take on that Washington Post series?
Well, I think that we have to better define the private sector, Rebecca, and I think that that's an important question. I think that I've usually looked at it as a three-legged stool. You obviously have general businesses, the companies that are community leaders in general, the Anheuser-Busch's, the Home Depot's, the Walmart's, who have to be prepared, have to develop product to respond to the general needs and have to help be part of this building a culture of preparedness in the event of any event. That's one segment of the quote-unquote private sector. The other segment that is so important is the critical infrastructure, the telecom, the transportation, the power grid. What I think that most people don't realize is that this is not about military or national security, where everyone wears uniforms and everybody is part of an internal insular community. Homeland Security involves every single citizen. So whether you're general business or whether you're critical infrastructure, those are obviously important parts and component parts. The third leg of the stool are the folks that provide the solutions. Whether they are training people that will eventually go into government and come back into the private sector, this kind of cyclical aspect where you have this understanding of how government best works and what private sector does best, or you have people that, in point of fact, provide, as Norma was even talking about, very, very dynamic technological services, component parts, products, technology across the board. All of those things have to be recognized as a component part of a safer and more secure nation. And if we just simply say government can run by itself or the private sector can run without government, I think we're missing important parts of a puzzle that will eventually keep us from achieving, I think, which is the ultimate goal, mission success, which is, as I said earlier, a safer and more secure homeland.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. I'd like to ask both of you this question, kind of open up the floor, if I could, about how you think things have changed since the devastating attacks on Washington and New York on September 11th, 2001. You know, we are fast approaching the ninth year of since the tragedy took place. Can you describe how things have changed on the Homeland Security front? Are we a safer nation?
Well, maybe I'll try and grab that one, and then Mark, I know that you will pick up very quickly for me. Rebecca, I mean, I think you know, the three of us know, and everyone listening, that the events of 9/11 were both a life-changing experience for all of us, but really, I think, a generation-changing experience. No one, at least from the American public's perspective, ever thought that what did happen could happen. And so I think you've had a couple of changes. One, I think that you have a much more aware nation. It does become harder in some respects the farther you go from an incident to make sure that people remain focused and on that all-hazards approach that Mark talked about. I do think that more people focus on a few things. We talk about preparedness, response, and recovery in our nation. Obviously, the goal is to reduce our vulnerability to threats or stop those incidents before they occur. But once they do, we have to respond with all means necessary. And then the big issue is, what's the recovery? How do we manage the situation and bring the economy and our lives back online? I do think the fact that the private sector owns 85 to 95% of the critical infrastructure has also changed the way people just do their daily business. To one of Mark's other points, just the role of the private sector can actually be sort of field troops, if you will, out there, being able to provide information and other things. I think our way of life has changed. I don't think it needs to be that we need to all put our head under the covers, but I think it has raised a different level of awareness. Mark?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that people kind of miss as well. I think that there's no question but that an organization like ours, the Department of Homeland Security, the nation's overall culture would be much different absent, it wouldn't even exist absent 9/11. But I think that the ever-evolving nature of the formation of a department, a brand new department, it's not like you pull education out of HEW and form a Department of Education. You really had to kind of consolidate so many different agencies and so many different cultures into this one thing now called Homeland Security, where 10 years ago today we weren't really talking about that. But if we can view what took place on that day as a true, you know, I know it's something that's bandied about in Washington all the time, but as a teaching moment, that we moved from a mentality of just terrorism to, a couple days later, dealing with anthrax, which was another form of terrorism, to a response to what hurricanes can do, to bridge collapses in our infrastructure, to an H1N1 kind of flu pandemic, to what we're dealing with in, you know, 90 days plus, the oil spill. The whole nature of what Homeland Security means is an ever-dynamic, ever-changing definition. And our country, and both the private sector and the public sector, have to be able to respond to that ever-changing dynamic in a way that doesn't allow us to just always go back and say, what if, but what can we do going forward? We have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. And as Norm was talking about, we have to be in a different kind of cultural mindset of preparation, not that we're going to stop it. We're not going to stop the hurricane. We're not necessarily going to be always lucky on stopping terrorism that might come within our border, whether it be cyber or physical. But in point of fact, we have to be able to be as resilient and as prepared as possible so that we can minimize the damage, mitigate the damage, both to our physical infrastructure, to human life, and to our overall economy. And that's what the private sector and the federal government and the state and local governments and increasingly global governments, whether you have a Mumbai or a Spain train incident or a tube incident in London, that increasingly the world is working together and collaborating as much as possible to, in essence, be as resilient as we can in the face of things that are both natural disasters and obviously human component terrorism.
Well, that's a good way to wrap up our conversation that we're having today on Capital Thinking Radio. We've got Mark Pearl here, President and CEO of the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council, and Norma Cram, a former federal official and the chair of Patton Boggs Homeland Security Practice. Thank you both very much for your time. I hope that we can continue the dialogue on this on future shows.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Have a great day.
You too.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. To the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Capital Thinking Radio Show. I'm Rebecca Carr, a former national correspondent with Cox Newspapers, subbing in today for Kevin O'Neill. Our next segment takes us a hard look at the controversy over the Defense Department's decision to send two Guantanamo Bay prisoners back to Africa against their will. Our guest is Todd Harrison, a former federal prosecutor who has extensive experience combating terrorism. Todd has also dealt with a number of international law issues, including money laundering, export control, and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations. Thank you, Todd, so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
So, Todd, I was hoping that you could tap into your experience at the Department of Justice, where for nearly 6 years you served as a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of New York, most recently as a deputy chief of the Violent Crimes and Terrorism Section. It seems that you know quite a bit of about terrorism, and you might have some comment about what happened here in the Guantanamo Bay case. First, some background for our listeners. Two men were held in Guantanamo Bay for nearly 8 years without any trial, without any type of adjudication. They have been released by the Pentagon to Africa. The first man, Abdul Aziz Naji, was sent to Algeria against his will. According to human rights groups, they say he fears persecution there as well as torture. Abdul al-Nasir Mohammed Kantumi of Syria was also transferred to West Africa. So far, there are 178 detainees remaining at Guantanamo. Guantanamo case has raised a number of constitutional rights issues, and I thought perhaps we could get some reaction from you, Todd, There's concern in the human rights community that it is wrong to deport prisoners who have not been convicted of any crimes to countries where they fear persecution or torture. Can you help our listeners understand the legal reasoning behind the decision to deport them?
Sure. Well, there are two basic categories of people who can legally be in the country, right? There are citizens who obviously have the right to be here. And then there are other folks who, you know, are given a limited right to be in the country, a visa for a certain period of time, for instance, for a certain purpose. The folks that are being held in Guantanamo certainly aren't citizens, and we're obviously not going to voluntarily give them visas to come into the country. Even those that have that we don't have sufficient evidence to prove crimes of terrorism against, for most of them, there are links to terrorist groups and things like that. And certainly as a political matter, the government is not going to allow any of those folks to legally come into the United States. Then you're left with the question of, if they're not legally allowed to be in the United States, what do you do with them? And that's just a centuries-old sort of basic immigration question. If they don't have the legal right to be here, you got to ship them back somewhere. And normally you ship them back to their country of origin. And we've always had, in the immigration courts and the civilian court system, the ability to for people in that type of situation who are being deported to challenge their deportation based on an argument that they would be subjected to torture or other severe issues back in their home country. In this case, the courts essentially have not bought that argument from these particular detainees. So they're going to be sent back to their home countries.
There was a statement that was issued by the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been handling a lot of these detainee cases. They say they're deeply concerned that that these people will disappear into secret detention and face the threat of persecution by terrorist groups. Is secret detention something that raises issues in the court system here in the United States? Is that something that is a real issue for detainees who are being sent back home from Guantanamo?
It probably is an issue in the sense that for some of these folks, it's probably a possibility. Think about the government of Algeria, for instance, who is being asked to take in a person that we've detained on suspicion of terrorism. At the very least, for the last eight or so years, the government of Algeria doesn't have the constitutional protections that we have here, and they have much more leeway to detain people than we do. And think about their position; they're receiving someone who is at least has been suspected at some point of being a terrorist. They're probably not going to want to take the chance to release that person, and so they may well detain them. But in this particular case. But that's hard for people, who are fighting their deportation to prove, of course. And in this case, apparently there's been some assurances from the U.S. government and from the Pentagon that they have discussed that particular issue with the Algerian government. The Algerian government has given them some sort of assurances, it's unclear exactly what, that will not be allowed to happen in this case. Only time can tell on that particular front. But so it's very hard for someone facing deportation to prove, what might happen to them in the future. That's part of the factual analysis. And in this case, the detainee's request to remain here, or at least to remain in Guantanamo, has been denied.
The transfers bring the number of remaining detainees at Guantanamo to 178. And now that's down from 245 prisoners when President Obama took office in January 2009. From a former federal prosecutor's perspective, what should happen to the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay?
Well, it's hard to say. It's really a case-by-case basis. And what the administration has done is they set up a task force of federal prosecutors and others to do a case-by-case review of each of the detainees being held in Guantanamo. And that's was the right thing to do a review of those cases and get input. And that task force has made recommendations to the administration regarding each of those detainees and what should be done with them, based mostly on what evidence there is to try them for particular crimes. So they've basically been divided up into groups where there is enough evidence to try them, whether it's in civilian courts or military tribunals is still to be determined, or whether there is not sufficient evidence to try them and those people should be deported back to their home countries. Then there's a third group about which there may not be enough evidence to of particular crimes to try them either in civilian or military courts. But they do have other evidence that indicates that those people are dangerous. And so there's a question of whether you can detain those people indefinitely. And this review, while important, has raised a whole bunch of thorny issues for the administration. The first and most obvious one is, you know, for the people that the administration believes they have sufficient evidence against to try them for specific crimes, where do you try them? Do you try them in the traditional civilian court system, as the Obama administration has suggested, or do you try them in a military tribunal system? Is it, you know, are these war crimes? Is it something that's more properly tried before a military tribunal? Those are the thorny issues that the administration is dealing with right now, most prominently in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the mastermind of 9/11, put that horrible plot together, and they're trying to decide where to try him. Originally, Attorney General Eric Holder came out at the end of last year and said that they were going to try him in civilian court in New York, and that raised a whole bunch of legal and political issues. There was uproar in New York, and the administration pulled back from that decision and still hasn't made a decision on where and how to try a case like that for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There's still a question of whether it will be tried in the civilian courts or a military tribunal. The Obama administration has continued to indicate that they'll probably try and use a civilian court, but they haven't announced that definitively. So there's a whole bunch of thorny issues raised by this.
They're really fascinating issues. I'm just wondering, you know, going back to Guantanamo, though, why has there been a delay on the closure? I mean, this is a camp that President Obama pledged to close. Can you explain from a legal perspective why it's so challenging to close this camp?
Sure. Well, the one thing was that to do a proper review of all of the evidence against all the, you know, 180-plus folks in there took a while. And rightly so. They took their time. They apparently have done a thorough review. And that's a good thing. So that took a while. It took longer, I think, than the administration expected. And then they had a lot of political pushback when they announced their decision to try a lot of these folks in civilian courts. They just run into a political wall, and they've been unable to do anything. And frankly, these detainees who have argued that they would rather stay in Guantanamo then be deported back to their home countries has also raised sort of an interesting question, too, which is some of the groups on the left have said that, you know, there are improper or inhumane conditions at Guantanamo. Well, the detainees' argument themselves seems to sort of undercut that. They're saying they'd rather stay there than go back to their home country. So it's a whole bunch of thorny political issues.
I want to thank you, Todd, for coming on Capital Thinking Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Todd Harrison, a former federal prosecutor who has deep experience in combating terrorism as well as white-collar crime and FCPA issues. Thank you very much, Todd.
Thanks, Rebecca.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, and welcome back to the Capital Thinking Radio Show. I'm Rebecca Carr, a former national correspondent with Cox Newspapers, subbing in today for host Kevin O'Neill. In our next segment, we take a look at the promise of the Chesapeake Crescent Initiative. With us today is Herbert S. Miller. Herb is the co-founder of the Chesapeake Crescent Initiative, and we're thrilled to have him on the show. Herb, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of information about what the Crescent Initiative is all about and what the Chesapeake Crescent Initiative hopes to accomplish.
Thank you for having me on the show. About 3 years ago, the governors of Maryland and Virginia and the mayor of the district, along with GSA, OMB, and FedLabs, got together and said the region of Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and sometimes Delaware is the most affluent, most educated area in America. It receives over $25 billion a year in federal research dollars in FedLabs, and there's 70 in that region, like NIH and NASA, et cetera, and the major research universities from Johns Hopkins to the University of Virginia to Georgetown to GW to George Mason and Virginia Tech. And with all of that investment by the federal government, this region was 37th in its efficiency of converting that to businesses and jobs. Well, clearly, we don't need to go a long way to realize that in the past 3 years, the realization of the need for jobs and business growth has been much bigger than ever before. And what we realized is that most of the investment by the federal government in this region is in energy, life sciences, and security. 60% alone is in security research. And the second largest is life science. So we decided to bring together the federal government, state and local governments, private sector and universities in an effort to optimize the creation of new businesses and provide a format for success in that creation of innovation-based driven jobs and businesses. And it's been quite interesting. There is not a lot of governors don't get a lot of votes for helping other states. But here we have small states that were shooting at each other about 150 years ago, and their relationships are mixed, and the only way they're going to succeed is working together. I think the Chinese government said that it takes 15 to 30 million people to make an economic unit. Well, they have a lot larger population there. If you add Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Delaware, and West Virginia, 16 million people. And basically, it's one large economic unit. But what we now call regional innovation clusters, that they didn't have a name for them back in 3 years ago, is really where regions are getting together and maximizing, optimizing their resources for growth. That's what we've focused on.
That's really interesting. So it sounds like the Chesapeake Crescent Initiative is really creating a business and policy cultural shift in this region by pulling together these four states and working together in a collaborative way.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've started a lot of businesses myself, being an entrepreneur. George Vredenburg, who was my co-founder of this and is absolutely amazing, who made his fortune at AOL, but before that ran and executive vice president of Fox, and before that was general counsel of CBS, came from a totally different segment. An entrepreneur can take on a given project, but when you're talking about the seriousness and the magnitude of energy from offshore wind, which takes three states and federal government and all kinds of complexities, to energy efficiency, which is the lowest hanging fruit in the energy scale in this country, but it takes local jurisdictions, state and federal, it takes hundreds of thousands of owners to work together. It cannot be done by one individual city or one individual state or the federal government by themselves. It takes teamwork. And that's where we believe this new approach to regional innovation clusters is the intelligent way to optimize this. How do you take the 70 Fed labs in this region and integrate their enormous amount of research and innovation sitting out there into making new businesses in security? It's probably the biggest expenditure of the federal government, probably over $1 trillion a year is spent in all aspects of security, from spooks to military to homeland to keep going. You know, how do you build a 21st century opportunity in this region to grow businesses on that and make the federal government more effective in its process?
I think that's a really, really good question. And I'm sure that question came up yesterday when your Chesapeake Crescent Initiative pulled together that summit, so to speak, on the Hill. I guess the summit was entitled Building an Energy-Efficient Region, the Path Forward. I understand that Maryland Mayor Martin O'Malley was there, as well as House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Can you talk a little bit about that conference and what was achieved during the breakout panels on creating an energy-efficient region?
Governor O'Malley, who was one of the keynote speakers, has been really active in this effort for 3 years. He's been quite forthright, and whatever he said he's done, he's had great follow-through on the initiatives with Chesapeake Crescent, and I've been very impressed with his business acumen and follow-through, and he has great people around him, and he's quite an impressive governmental leader. And what he's done with his people, from John Ratcliffe, Director of Policy, to Malcolm Wolf, Director of Energy, is work with Virginia, work with Delaware, work with the district in emphasizing the growth potential of these three major areas of security, life sciences, and energy. In terms of energy itself, the opportunity to do energy efficiency is pretty amazing. When we first started the Chesapeake Crescent, we got the three jurisdictions and the federal government to commit to 400 buildings for energy efficiency saving. This is over 2 years ago. Taking $37 million out of energy cost and take equivalent to 47,000 cars off the road. Now we are trying to develop mechanisms and strategies and integrations where the private sector, and they're very sophisticated private sector companies that are big and they're less sophisticated ones. You have General Services Administration, which is the largest landlord of 100 million feet in that region, and how do they work with the private sector? How do they work with local governments? How does some of the federal initiatives actually make things happen in a region. And that's what the coming together was. One, from how do you finance energy efficiency in a very tight credit market, which we worked on. What companies are really good at helping owners figure out energy efficiency? At the federal level and the state level, you know, you can have all these federal mandates, but people have to do it at home. They have to do it in their communities. So we had Arlington County and the District of Columbia and Baltimore County come together with the federal government and say, gee, what can we do? What can GSA do? Here, look out in Baltimore County. You have the headquarters of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. It's probably have 30 or 40,000 employees. The Social Security alone has 20. Why can't that be a community microgrid where they come together with the other owners in the area and share information and develop a green proving ground of what really works and doesn't work? What are the practical solutions to integrate transportation, and what are the clean energy things that can be done integrated with it? Can you put geothermal in the parking lots? Can you put solar over the roads? You know, what can be done? And what's so interesting is Jay Fizette, who's the county executive of Arlington County and a very, very progressive county, is going to be able to share his experiences at the Pentagon, at Crystal City, Pentagon City, major projects, into integrating that along with Roslyn and the Boston Corridor into high energy efficiency solutions that can then be shared across our entire region to other counties and other communities. And with GSA as the lead in this, and they have $1.5 billion just in the National Capital Region, probably $2.5 billion they're spending in energy efficiency in these three or four states, how does that have a multiplier effect in the private sector and in government buildings to learn from them, to share from them? What can we do together to reduce peak load? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you realize it. You know, at 4 o'clock in the morning in a cold winter, it might cost 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Today, at 2 p.m, it's probably $1.25 a kilowatt hour. There are not many supplies that have that enormous range.
Really interesting. Well, I want to thank you, Herb, for coming on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Herb Miller, chairman of the Western Development Corporation and co-founder of the Crescent Initiative. And we're very, very pleased to have him on and to describe how the Crescent Initiative is becoming a catalyst for change here in the Washington region to find new innovations in energy.
To learn more about it.
That would be great. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you again. I appreciate it.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Rebecca Carr, former national correspondent with Cox Newspapers, subbing in today for host Kevin O'Neill. In our final segment today, we talk with Gregory Walden, a nationally recognized aviation authority. He's going to talk to us about the pending legislation that's now impacting the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Mr. Walden counsels airlines, air taxi operators, cargo carriers, fixed-base operators, just about everybody in the airline industry with matters before the U.S. Department of Transportation and the FAA, as well as the National Transportation Safety Board. He's also well-known for his expertise on U.S. Customs and Border Protection and his work before Congress. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Rebecca.
When you last were on the program back in April, the House and Senate had each passed a bill to reauthorize Federal Aviation Administration programs, but differences between the two bills were not yet resolved. What is the current status of the legislation, and can you, for our listeners, differentiate authorization versus appropriations? Because I think people immediately think when something's authorized that it's going to be paid for, and that's not necessarily the case, is it, Greg?
No, of course not. Congress must first authorize a program and then in a separate bill appropriate money. So there are some times they do it in the same bill, but most times it's a multi-year reauthorization of a program and then an annual appropriation. And often the appropriation amounts are not as much as the authorized amounts, and that we're finding that to be the case with the FAA. But the legislation that's before the Congress right now is a bill to reauthorize the federal aviation programs. That's air traffic, that's aviation standards, that's money that goes to airports for airport development. And even though the House and Senate passed their bills, I think several months ago, they never went to a conference, which is what most people who take government civics would expect. They didn't go to a conference because there's a provision in the House bill that would make it easier to unionize Federal Express, by putting Federal Express ground workers under the Railway National Labor Relations Act. Right now they're under the RLA, the Railway Labor Act, and the only way the Teamsters perhaps can organize Federal Express is to organize Federal Express nationwide. So there's this provision in the House bill that would put the FedEx ground workers under the National Labor Relations Act, and the Tennessee senators objected to going to conference between the House and Senate so long as this provision is in the House bill and might survive conference. And so what we've had is staff-to-staff negotiations for weeks, and now we're getting to member-to-member negotiations in the House and staff, although there's not a formal conference. There was word earlier this week that the bill would go to the Senate floor first, and almost like a ping-pong where the Senate would pass the bill, go to the House, and if the House didn't accept the Senate bill in toto, then the House would pass its bill and then ping-pong back to the Senate to accept the House bill or make changes. We're kind of there right now, but the Senate, I don't think, has yet reached agreement among its own membership with respect to the text of the bill. There are a couple outstanding issues.
That's interesting. What are those outstanding issues?
Well, one is, will there be an increase in the passenger facility charge? Airports have been pushing for an increase from the $4.50 maximum passenger facility charge per segment, because if you looked at the increase in inflation and the construction costs, that $4.50 would have to be $8 today to make up what it was in 2000. So the House bill has a $7 maximum. The Senate bill contained no increase. And one of the things is, well, what are they going to compromise? Are they going to reach the difference, split the difference between 450 and 7? The Senate is now talking about 550, and the House, I understand, has counteroffered with 650. That's not yet resolved. Another issue is slots at Reagan National Airport. As many of you may know, that Reagan National Airport is now the only airport in the country that is slot controlled. And so you can't, an airline just can't fly into Reagan National Airport. It has to get permission. It has to acquire a slot from another airline or through perhaps an exemption proceeding. And the House bill would increase, there's also a perimeter rule so that there are very few flights. Only 24 flights can go beyond the 1,250-mile perimeter at Reagan National Airport. And the House bill would allow for 10 additional outside-the-perimeter operations, daily operations. The Senate bill had no additional operations, but there were something like 8 or 9 amendments on the Senate floor, and a bunch of Western senators now have put together a proposal, I've not seen the text, that would allow for up to 48 inside-the-perimeter slots to be exchanged for outside-the-perimeter slots. That is, if United is flying almost every hour or on the half hour to between Reagan National and Chicago O'Hare, United could take some of those slots and move them to nonstop flights to San Francisco or Los Angeles.
Hmm. Could you name the senators that are interested in having more long-distance flights out of Reagan National Airport?
Well, I think you could probably name any senator from a state that's
so
more than 1,250 miles.
Would you care to comment on the politics behind that?
But, of course, they'd have to really be a large hub. I wouldn't say North Dakota or Wyoming, but definitely the Arizona senators favor this, the California senators favor it.
Senator Kyle apparently is
the moving force in the Senate for expanded operations. Now, I want to be clear about this, that because the Virginia senators have expressed concern about any expansion of operations at Reagan National Airport. Under the Senate proposal, as I understand it, it would be an exchange, so there would be no net gain in operations, that you'd take an inside-the-perimeter slot and exchange it for an outside-the-perimeter slot.
Mm-hmm. But the question is, does the marketplace demand this, or does the politics demand this?
Well, the perimeter rule is an artificial barrier. It was designed initially to foster the growth of Dulles Airport. Dulles is now grown, is an adult, and I don't think needs that same adult supervision protection that it had in the perimeter rule.
I see.
If the marketplace was open, you'd have twice as many operations as you do at Reagan National Airport. But you've got not only the slot control were put in place for air traffic control efficiency. At some point, it's unsafe to have an infinite number of operations at any one airport. You have planes hanging up in the air waiting to land. So the slots were put in for efficiency, but it really does have a damper on competition.
Where has the Obama administration been in this debate?
Well, good question, Rebecca, because I don't doubt that there are discussions between DOT and FAA and the House and Senate negotiators as to what they would like, but there's not been a formal statement from or a formal proposal from the Obama administration. When the Senate put together their multi-reauthorization period, they said, "Well, we're only going to reauthorize it for 2 years, so we can let the Obama administration put together a proposal." Whereas the House bill would be 3 years.
Hmm. Very interesting. So, who are the winners if the legislation is enacted?
Well, everyone, I think, to some extent. Passengers will win because there's a passenger bill of rights provision in there that's similar to but a little bit more expansive than what DOT is putting on in its rulemaking. Passengers will also see that increased safety requirements for feeder airlines following the Colgan Air accident. Airports will win if the passenger facility charge is increased. That's a big question mark. And airlines will win, I think, because the FAA, the Congress is promoting next generation air traffic control system in a number of measures.
Well, thank you, Greg, so much. I think that's our cue to sign off today for Capital Thinking Radio. Really appreciate Greg Walden, a nationally recognized aviation authority. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome, Rebecca. Have a good day.
Thank you to all the listeners, and we'll see you next week.
Joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.